The first case on this morning's calendar is Herzog versus Herzog, case number 73160. Is counsel for the appellant ready to proceed?
Yes.
Please let us know how much time you want to reserve for rebuttal.
Good. I'm going to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. You'll get a note, a beep on the buzzer.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Anne Traum, appearing on behalf of Mr. Herzog. Mr. Herzog urges this court to vacate the amended decree on visitation and support and to remand again, this time for a new evidentiary hearing to revisit both issues. I'd like to start with visitation and then I'll go to support, but I'm happy to entertain any questions at any time. There are three reasons why the one letter per month restriction on visitation must be reversed. First, the order lacks specific findings required by Davis. It lacks factual support in this record, and it violates Batista because it contains no benchmarks for modification, and the district court left that issue up to a therapist to decide in the future. As in Davis, the order still fails. It's already remanded once under Davis, but as in Davis, it still fails to explain why this extremely limited visitation was in the child's best interest, which is the test, and why alternatives like more letters per month or phone calls, which is what Mr. Herzog asked for at his trial, were rejected. The order cuts off all live contact between father and daughter indefinitely, and certainly by the terms of the decree, during his entire prison sentence. Now, we expect, as they did at trial, that he would be released in November. That's still the expectation. But his sentence is 48 to 120 months. That's the entirety of his daughter's life as a minor.
So the 48 is up in November, or the lower part?
I don't know
is...
if it's exactly 48, but he's likely going to be paroled in November.
Okay.
But his sentence, and the district court mentioned this and says this in the decree, is 48 to 120 months. So if the decree doesn't even contemplate more visitation or supervised visits at all, or anything other than the one letter restriction, for the entirety of his prison term, and gives no, and I'll get to this in a minute, but gives no indication of how, what he's supposed to do to get more visitation.
And then it outsources the visitation to the therapist who didn't testify and whose letter was excluded at time of trial, correct?
Yes, exactly, which is why this record, so I don't think that the district court can fix this.
Is that the case? I don't, looking at the decree itself, where does the judge outsource the decision to the child's therapist?
Right. So
I mean, it's unclear to me that the role of the therapist in this case is the same as the role in the Batista case. I'm not sure that they're analogous.
Okay, so let me just focus on what the decree says and why I think this is a much more egregious example of outsourcing. So first, the decree says, and this is page, volume 3, 397, which is on page 10 of the decree, upon Mr. Herzog's release from, so first on paragraph 4, it says that he can write one letter per month, shall be opened and read during the therapy sessions, and they should be mailed to this address. Then the next paragraph is, upon Mr. Herzog's release from prison, he may have supervised visitation with the minor child as recommended by the child's therapist. Such visitation may be expanded consistent with therapeutic recommendations. And then he can seek a motion to ask for more. So, he can file a motion or to show substantially changed circumstances, which is a high burden. But it actually lets the therapist decide what additional visitation will be possible, and it doesn't suggest that there's any other choice between these extremes, which is one letter per month and supervised visitation.
But isn't the root of this the court's findings on page 8, where she is saying at lines 11 through 18, it is in the best interest of the minor child that Ms. Herzog be awarded sole custody. Mr. Herzog has engaged in domestic violence towards Ms. Herzog in a repeated fashion and in the presence of the children for which they are now in therapy. The court may have considered joint legal custody. However, the facts of this case are so concerning and impacting on the emotional stability and well-being of the children and their confidence moving forward into childhood. Isn't the judge simply exercising caution in suggesting that when released, the visitation graduates based upon the therapist's assessment of the child's reaction to this?
So I just want to hit a few different issues related to that. First of all, that was particularly about custody, which we're not challenging. It's on page 9 that the visitation analysis exists. And it's extremely slim. Just says it's in the best interest of the minor child that he's entitled to visitation set forth below.
But don't we need to read the findings and the decree in its totality, not just a piece here?
I understand there's a history of domestic violence here, obviously. And that's what his prison sentence is related to that.
Well, there's more than just domestic violence, isn't there? I mean, isn't the judge implicitly expressing concern about the child's well-being and what the child has observed and what developed? Now, it is curious, I grant you that, how the judge arrives at this issue without the therapist's letter being admitted or that whole testimony thing being addressed appropriately. But nevertheless, it seems to me that being a fair reading of the judge's decree, who's closest to this than we are by far, is concerned about the child's relationship with her dad having been through this process.
So I understand those concerns. I obviously understand the concern about domestic violence. But I think it's important to see what's in the record here. So the therapist, nothing from the therapist because she's not there. Her letter is not in the record.
What's frustrating about these family court cases, though, is the judge may have this information, but it wasn't necessarily there by an admissible evidence process.
Well, I mean, this is judicial review, and we have to go by what is in the record. What is in the record is a court's finding on page 394 that Sean had a loving relationship with his daughter, and Kelly testified that she agreed to visitation, that Sean was a good father to Shay and never harmed her. So I think we do have to distinguish between domestic violence issues between the parents and directed at the children, and there's absolutely no indication that there's domestic violence directed at this child.
And the other piece of this that was really troubling to me, because I tried to go back and sort out what is actually of evidence in this record versus what's stated. I don't understand if the risk is domestic violence, let's credit that for purposes of argument, why, with no letter, no testimony from the therapist, no expert testimony, we don't know anything about the therapeutic relationship except that mom said she put the kids in therapy. Why would it be the case that a man who's incarcerated can only write a letter to his child, one letter per month? What is the basis for that kind of limitation?
I think
in this record.
But there's no explanation for that in this record.
And then it has to be sanitized and open, you know, the menacing dad has got to be opened in the therapist's office. He can't have even a letter that is read by the child in the privacy of the child's room or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So there's, I mean,
I guess the text messages on the older daughter's phone maybe explain that. I don't know.
Yes. I mean, perhaps. But there's really nothing that explains why one letter, why not two letters, why not phone calls.
As many letters as he wants.
Or why not phone calls, which is what he asked for. And Davis says you have to explain what you're imposing. You also have to explain why you are rejecting alternatives. And this is not an abstract alternative. This is what he asked for at trial. He said that he wanted to have phone calls with her. Why can't I have phone calls with her? And so what the problem is that, and this goes to the outsourcing to the therapist. Now the therapist is in charge. Mr. Herzog has a decree. It's not his therapist. And unlike in Batista, this is not even a court referee or a court employee or an agency, right? This is a private therapist. And so that's why I think it's actually more egregious than Batista. There's no sort of official role that this therapist is playing as a referee. It's the child's therapist. And that's appropriate. And of course, her expertise is valuable. It's her decision-making which is the problem, right? So, of course, the district court would have been better off if it had
Other than opening the letter, what decision-making does the therapist have under this decree? the therapist's involvement doesn't kick in until he's released from prison, other than opening the letters.
Well, that's another problem in terms of Davis, right? This goes on indefinitely. It's extremely restrictive without justification. And there's no graduating.
He could file a motion the day he gets out of prison. That's what it says.
This contemplates that this would still be in effect when he gets out of prison. And because it's still in effect when he gets out of prison, it's not clear to me that he would even have a basis for showing substantial change of circumstances under this particular order. That was actually the issue in Davis, too, which is the lack of clarity in the original order meant that there were no judicial benchmarks for giving instruction to a parent about what it is that they're supposed to show to demonstrate substantially changed circumstances in order to get a modification hearing, which would be his burden to show. I do want to, I'm running out of time, I do want to just briefly talk about support before I sit down, and then I'll reserve the remainder for rebuttal. The support issue is, the district court plainly erred because the statute is very clear, and under the statute, the sole issue on the statutory minimum is ability to pay. The district court erred because once it found that Mr. Herzog did not have the ability to pay the minimum amount, which it did find orally and in writing, it lacked the discretion under the statute to impose that amount anyway. And we're going to hear an invitation to maybe look elsewhere to Pennsylvania or other states on this issue. But I don't think that there's any reason, because the statute is clear on this. There's no reason to carve out a judicial exception to what the legislature has instructed. The legislature is very clear. There's a formula. If the formula doesn't...
So, Ms. Fromm, what do you think the court should have set the support at, assuming we agree with you? What should you set it at?
I think that there is an obligation, obviously, always to pay support. And I think it has to set it at a level that Mr. Herzog could afford, and then to come back when he's out and have a new hearing.
So if he's in prison, he can't afford anything, basically.
The district court didn't even ask Mr. Herzog at the trial whether he was employed in prison. And that would have been relevant, right, to say, look, you're only making $40 a month or whatever it is, but let's at least set aside a portion of that or all of it or some reasonable amount so that he can meet his obligations. What's going to happen here is that he's going to be strapped with obligations that are not, he cannot meet when he comes out of prison. That's what Fernandez cautioned against, strapping someone with a burden that they can't meet. That's actually not in the person's interest, and it's not in their child's interest either. I'm going to reserve, unless there's a question on that particular issue, I'll reserve.
No, I'll add 2 minutes to your time and 2 minutes to his as well.
Okay, thank you.
We've asked you a lot of questions. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Christopher Berg for the respondent. There's three reasons why the district court's decision should be affirmed. First, it was not an abuse of discretion. Second, any error was harmless. And third, the issue on tools are moot. A little disadvantage here in the tool issue because it wasn't raised before. So I'll address it before the end. But in terms of one letter per month as some abuse of discretion, the judge sat there and decided it was in the best interest of the children. Mr. Herzog had used the cell phone of one of the daughter to get at the wife. So the judge is intervening, not allowing him. We're talking about a serial stalker, somebody who's more likely to be prisoner of the year than father of the year. And he uses the children to get to the wife. So the judge said, okay, once a month, have an intermediary person read it. In case there's stuff in there, hey, I want to kill your mom, they don't want the child to get that letter and see that. And so the judge said, once a month is enough. We have in the record, Mr. Herzog leaves for 2 and 3 weeks at a time. So, and it's not something one time, it was over 4 or 5 years. So this isn't a man who's in his kids' lives anyway.
But the finding is that they had a loving relationship, he and Shay. And I don't know if Shay is a boy or a girl. The record's kind of unclear on that. But
it's a daughter.
So two daughters. They had two daughters. What's concerning to me, and I look at this, he's in prison, he's incarcerated, and the risk of violence is obviously cabined by his incarceration. His contact with that child, the younger of the two, is
like if you could snuff a flame out and give the very minimum amount that would still constitute any kind of parental contact with this child, this would be it. This is as limited as you can possibly get.
Except that the daughter can contact him any time she wants.
No, she can write him letters.
Right, anytime
she can't
she
call
wants.
Him.
Well, okay, contact him by letter anytime she wants. So if she wants to send him a letter every day, she can.
But how do you maintain that relationship? I mean, I understand assuming that parents are deeply flawed, and this man in particular, you know, is obviously a flawed human being, but he has a relationship, father-daughter, and our statutes say those are to be preserved to the extent possible. And I am really troubled by no therapist's testimony, no evidence as to the child's, this daughter's mental well-being. She's 8 years old, and the judge refused to hear from her on her preferences, saying she's too young to articulate them. It almost, I don't know, I'm troubled by that. And I'm troubled under Batista that it seems to me, as I read this decree, that it's up to the therapist to decide when and if he has anything more than one sanitized letter per month, even upon release from prison. I don't think that's a... And how does he show changed circumstances? We had another case last week on the burden of demonstrating changed circumstances, and if you don't come with a showing of substantially changed circumstances under Ellis, you can't get out of the chute. You can't get a hearing. So what's he to show?
Well, let me address Bautista, which apparently just came down a few months ago. That dealt with custody. This deals with visitation. I think there's a difference there. So I don't think Bautista is determinative of this case. Plus, as Justice Hartstein noted, the judge ultimately said, bring it to me. Yeah, the therapist can ask for more. If you're not happy, bring it to the court, and the court can decide.
But he already had the right to file a motion. He could file a motion now.
So he doesn't lose any rights.
Except that the court has stated that the therapist has to recommend a change for him to proceed. That's what this says.
Well, he can go to court and say, I want to get my own therapist and have them make a recommendation. I mean, it doesn't stop him from getting anything in the future.
Okay.
In terms of the child support itself, I read the statute as two prongs. The judge has to say, you're unable to pay, so I'm going to reduce it to $50 or zero. She said, yeah, you're in prison, you can't pay it, but I'm making it $100. So the two prongs aren't met. It's $100 a month. The fact that he may owe a few thousand when he gets out, that's pretty light. I could see people in the future saying, great, let's get out of child support by going to jail. Let's beat up the ex-wife, go to jail, and then I don't have to pay support either. This is another way to get it. When you're dealing with people who aren't that stable, that's the way they think. So to say, well, he's in jail, he should be off the hook, it hurts the children. True, they may never get the support, but there is the possibility there if he goes back to work. In terms of the tools, there's a bunch of issues.
Before you leave the support issue, I had a question about the period of time from October of 2014 through, he's in jail, he's incarcerated, but he's not in prison, and the parties are separated, and mom is supporting the kids. And I was trying to think through why he, when he's in jail and he's not spending any of the community money and mom is spending the community money on the kids, why he should pay support during that period of separation, if indeed there was separation. And I'd appreciate your thoughts on that.
Sounds like the reason people have to pay support anyway. Just because the mom is paying doesn't mean she's making ends meet, that everything's hunky-dory. She's struggling herself.
But that statute talks about reasonable expenses of mom during this period. And is there any evidence in record of those expenses during that October 2014? It's like a 10-month period.
No.
Okay.
But there's no evidence that there was some extravagant living going on between Ms. Herzog.
And is there any evidence of separate property of Ms. Herzog going to those presumed expenses?
No, in fact, it was just the opposite. She's paying to keep his tools in storage.
Okay.
And the storage unit fee was more than the child support that was ordered.
Right, I got that.
So in terms of the tools, first of all, it's community property. So half of it was hers anyway. When you break it down, they got $4,400. You split it in half, $2,200. $1,400 went to pay his portion of the rent, storage rent. So we're talking about $800. That's number one. Number two, are the tools exempt? Are they exempt if you're in jail for 4 years? You don't know if somebody's going to hire you after being a felon, whether you can get certified as a mechanic again. And so, and if anybody, not only would they just hire you, but that your tools aren't even out of date after 4 years. And this is 4 years at a minimum. He may be in 10 years. So to say they're exempt at this point is questionable. I understand he made a living in the past on it. But more importantly, 125.150 paren 5 says the separate property of a spouse can be used to pay for child support. And that's what the judge did. And again, $800. They thought they were going to get thousands, and some money would be held aside to pay future support. And finally, the statute that appellant cites, 125.250, which says, well, if it's exempt, you can't use it for child support. That's where a court appoints a trustee to hold property and sell it. And somebody can file a motion to stop that. That didn't happen here. It was their property. No trustee was appointed. And
how does that distinguish the statute? I understand, and I had the same question, but the court ordered the property sold to satisfy the back support that was owed and to meet it forward. But that statute does talk about exemptions, the exemption statutes in NRS Chapter 21 applying.
If the property is held by a trustee. And I'm
Why
saying,
wouldn't that apply here, too? What's the difference?
Well, she's not a trustee. It was their property. And so it wasn't given over to a trustee, because that statute talks about NRS 104, financing statements and the like on personal property. Okay. This had nothing to do with that. Did Mr. Herzog.
So you don't agree that mom would sort of be a de facto trustee of dad's community share for purposes of that sale? You would reject that analysis of that sale?
No, I wouldn't, because the court can say, okay, I want the property put aside, and we're going to get a trustee involved. They're going to sell it, and they're going to keep track of it and report to the court and do a financing statement. None of that happened. It was sell it, pay the child support. But even if it was, 125.150 paren 5 says separate property of a spouse can be used to pay child support. So that's not even an issue. And I just want to make a point on the, going back to the child support. Mr. Herzog stated on page 293, I leave it up to your discretion to try and figure out this whole child support. I'm okay with 100 a month. So he should be judicially stopped from now coming in and saying 100 a month is too much. If there's no other questions.
Justice Hardesty. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 4 minutes and 39 seconds.
Okay, thank you. I just want to say first on the visitation issue, Nevada policy, we're not talking about custody. Visitation is less than custody. We are not challenging the custody determination here. And this is the most extreme restriction on visitation that I have ever heard of. It's not that a court can't impose the most extreme visitation. It's that when it does so, it has to explain why. And it has to explain why for the benefit of the parent, both parents, for the benefit of the child, and for the benefit of this court reviewing that order and for future courts who will be asked to enforce that order or make a change. That's what the procedural requirements are. Not that the district court couldn't do this or might have had a basis for doing this. It's just that you cannot tell from this record where the court said that there was a loving relationship, et cetera, that there is a basis for it. On support, we made clear in our briefing that Mr. Herzog was led to believe that there was nothing below the $100 per month per child, and that's not what the statute says. So it's a plain violation of the statute by the district court in failing to understand what the legislature dictated, and that was that if the person can't pay, and you find that in writing, you cannot impose that amount. Now, there would be then a hearing to determine what's amount, the proper amount to impose. And then on the tools, I just want to highlight a few things about this. I agree that there was a little bit of, I can understand this concern about whether this statute really applies when the court in the sort of first instance is working out who owes what to whom and the parents. But the statute...
You mentioned it, that's the only asset that they had, effectively.
It's not the only asset that they had, because the district court ignored that there were cash assets, that there were bank accounts that were unexplored, and we cite to Mr. Herzog talked about those bank accounts. He says, we shared a bank account that had $15,000 before I was released from jail, and now it's gone. There was a car that he said was actually paid off, and the district court regarded as a debt. So the court seemed to kind of to violate the policy, because the policy of the statute is this, that the court should not liquidate a parent's source of livelihood in order to pay for child support arrears. It's not that it can never do that, but when it does seek to do that, it's got to look at other assets first, because these are not the same fungible assets as other fungible assets. So it's got to look to cash and other more liquid assets first. It's got to give notice. It's got to give opportunity to stop the sale. And livelihood is a defense. The statute says that a defense would be that this would substantially impair the ability of the obligor parent to generate income. And then the question about whether this applies here, 125B210 says that this applies in any proceeding where the court has ordered a parent to pay for the support of a minor child. So this court talked about arrears. It was not just giving a prospective award of child support. It talked about collecting arrears and used the tools to do that. So I think that this qualifies as any proceeding where the court has ordered a parent to pay for the support of a minor child and is now collecting on that judgment. That's exactly what the court was doing in the decree.
But by its terms, I mean, your opponent has a fair point that this really wasn't the machinery of that statute. It looks like it, but it isn't quite. There's no trustee.
So I agree that that's where the sort of gray area is. And to that, I would say both common sense, but more importantly, the policy of the legislature is very clear, which is you don't execute on someone's livelihood until you've exhausted some procedural protections, namely looking at other assets first, giving notice, an opportunity to stop the sale, and for them to make their case. What he said on the record was, this is my livelihood when I do get released from prison. So to sell them, to me, it would be a great battle to get back what I've accumulated over almost 20 years. Okay. And it's also short-sighted, because at the end of the day, who does this benefit? No one. I mean, no one is better off because of this. The child is not better off. The tools were sold at a fire sale. And this is going to be relevant to a remand support order or a defense of failing to pay child support if you affirm on the support order.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The matter will stand submitted.